This is Andrew, and Wolf, my topic this week is, actually, it's 64-bit transition, which sounds probably a little odd, considering that everyone should have gone through that, you know, years ago now.
Well, you're always behind the times, right?
But that's the thing, we're a non-topical show, so I think there's a, and there's some value to it, I think, for one, because I did recently go through it again for an iOS codebase. So I was thinking about it a little more. I have some things I can talk about. And it was interesting to be doing it at this stage. Because at this point, I've done it a couple of times.
The debate's really settled and you're going back to 32-bit?
Yes. Yes, that's it. Actually, we're going to split the difference. We're going to go 48 bits. So I'm kind of an old hand at it. I knew what I was doing. I sort of had the script down as far as what to do and what the gotchas were. But I was dealing with some engineers who had not been through it before. And so some of the questions that they had about the process were kind of rekindled some of my own, some of the misgivings I had had earlier on that kind of been paved over by repetition and, you know, sort of lack of problems and that sort of thing. So I wanted to go through a little bit of that today. Specifically, what's the deal with NS Integer?
Is this a Seinfeld thing?
Yeah, right. So we're all used to NS Integer being used everywhere now, to the point where if you see int, a bare int in a code base in the woods, that you know, you're like, well, you know, that's wrong. That's something just in and of itself. That's bad, and you should change it.
Well, at least in a .m file, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, in anywhere in Objective-C. But the question that came up was, well, why not just use int everywhere? Now, one reason not to use int everywhere that people come up with when they talk about these transitions is, well, int is not a fixed size. So you don't know what you're getting, necessarily. Now, that may be true in all the platforms in all the world, but Apple's platforms, you know, they've got two of them, mm-hmm. maybe three if you consider the Apple TV, although the Apple TV is basically iOS, as far as I understand it. So they've only had two platforms. The watch is coming up. Okay, the watch might blow this theory out of the water, but I would actually bet that the watch will not be very different from iOS in terms of its CPU power. And so, you know, you've got two platforms at most, two modes in both platforms. And the int has actually been established as 4 bytes in every platform so far, in every variation of every platform. So why would it be bad for Apple to just say, you know what, it's always going to be 4 bytes, you're just going to assume for our platforms int is 4 bytes, and we're done. That's even conformant to the standards, right? Because the standards are extremely loose about, you know, how big the sizes are for things. So Apple could just say, well, okay, we follow the standards, but we have a little bit more going on where we are. But they didn't do that. They said, okay, no, int bad, NS Integer good. And they said, well, we'd convert everywhere to NS Integer. So now you've converted everything because you were told to, because Apple said to. You know, now what? Well, you've doubled your size of your data mm-hmm. on 64-bit. But you can't actually use any of those extra bytes. Because by definition, during your transition from one platform to another, there are still going to be people on the old platform. Mm-hmm. And so if you have any sharing of data whatsoever, which most people would at this point, even if you're not a networked application, you've got documents, you've got a variety of things that are going to be saved to disk and brought back up, and therefore the possibility of having this data be shared between the two platforms. And if you say, well, certain amounts of data are stored as an NS integer, and now we're going to let them be numbers that are ludicrously large, such that they'll use more than 4 bytes in them. Well, if you take that data back to your 32-bit platform, to your app on the 32-bit platform, that'll get truncated, and that'll be bad. And you might think, oh, that would never happen. I actually know. I was just recently talking with someone who got bit by that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, and integers, I think, especially are more likely than floats to have this problem, I think, because, you know, counting things, taking the measurements of things as integers seems like something where you can usually have larger numbers than that. Even for things like IDs, right? If you have a giant database, well, then that's, or a database that has a lot of turnover, for example, you might reach that sooner rather than later. So what's the actual benefit of using an annotator? You can't actually use the higher amount of space. That's all you really get is a bigger space that you can't use. You know, if you actually need to use a bigger space, int 64_t, right? That's generally what you would recommend for people to use, something of a fixed size that's larger. So now there is an answer, at least an answer that I can think of, as to why you would do this. Wolf, can you think of a reason?
What am I thinking of a reason for exactly?
For why your int should be 8 bytes on 64-bit platforms.
Or to make use of virtual memory, the full 64-bit address space. But of course, that's a lie. But
well, and you don't have virtual memory on the iPhone.
Yeah, but I've attacked this first from the Mac perspective, which actually does make a difference on there. But it's still not really 64 bits.
I agree. So the answer comes to me from something that I've already talked about, and I talked about it back in our Scripting with C episode back in October of last year. I talked about John Syracuse's review of OS 10.10 Yosemite, his page on Swift, which was really interestingly technically complex for a general purpose OS review. And he really got down to the details of Swift, where he talked about how you go from the types of Swift, which are classes, which are not primitives, all the way down through all the compiler optimization levels, down to CPU primitives. Mm-hmm. And in particular, he was talking about integer, which is why it made me think of it. Now, the Swift integer type, just called int, is actually has the same, as far as I remember, has the same properties as NS integer, in that it is 4 bytes on 32-bit platforms and 8 bytes on 64-bit platforms. But then if you take it down, if you say, okay, that number is going down to a 4-byte int in the CPU, then you realize, well, the integer type for the CPU, what you would use when you're doing integer operations on the CPU, those are 4 bytes on 32-bit. And on 64-bit, they're going to be 8 bytes. So whereas you might think, well, if I use a smaller type, even on a 64-bit platform, then it will be faster because I'm not using as much memory, because I'm not requiring as many bytes to be moved around when we're doing things. In fact, it's probably slower, simply because you have to do a lot of conversion into the native integer type before you can do integer operations on it. So I think that's a big reason why they did it for NS integer, and why they made the int type in Swift, where they could have done anything they wanted, they made that actually variable size depending on the platform as well. And so related to this, my next point is about the stages of the transition. And there are three stages of the transition. There's the before stage. There's
acceptance,
the during stage.
Denial.
Yes. Very good. Anger.
Yeah.
Cupcakes. Transition, performing the transition in anger, to use your parlance. So, of course, the before stage is in the past. Whenever you've started a transition, you're done. You can't do anything about it. But the next two stages are interesting because then you can start to think in terms of what you optimize for. Do you optimize for making the actual transition itself easy? Mm-hmm. Or do you optimize for the time after the transition being easier? And when you think about it, there isn't really much of a contest because the transition is only going to be a limited amount of time. And afterwards, it's pretty much the rest of the platform's existence until the next transition.
Until 128-bit.
Yes, which is quite a ways away, right, my understanding of things. So you really probably want to optimize for afterwards rather than during. And I think that's what Apple did. They said, well, you've got this weird thing where you've got types which are different sizes for no good benefit during the transition. But then when you're done with the transition, now everything's at that native larger size. You've got integers at the native larger size. You've got floats at the native larger size. You're all set. You've got this weird, you know, name for things, NS integer, but yeah, you can't really get around that. And you can see this in the way they recommend dealing with the other APIs, which are not their APIs. Now, of course, all their APIs take NS integer, NSU integer, everywhere. It takes CG float everywhere. But when you get things like standard C library functions, like fabs, and the format strings, and the format string, now Apple uses those in its Objective-C APIs, but the format string, the rules for it are not something that Apple came up with, as far as I'm aware of. They came from sort of standard F, whatever, stuff like that, printf.
Yeah.
And so for there, it's actually quite annoying, and I have fun every time I go through this migration. It is very annoying that you have to go through all your format strings and you have to do something with them, because they're very clear that if you leave your types as NS integer, they will complain. Mm-hmm. They don't like it. And what they do is they say, well, cast it to the larger type size, cast it to a long.
And that's actually an improvement, because do you remember there was at least one major release of Xcode that would alternate? It would tell you to change a format specifier, and then you change it to that. Then it would say, oh, no, you should change it to the other.
I've seen a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. I do know that with the very latest versions, well, sort of latest version of Xcode, they will actually, so before they would say, we'll change the format string,
mm-hmm.
and then, but they wouldn't cast it for it. You'd have to add the cast yourself.
Yeah.
The later version, the latest versions of Xcode, I'm not sure whether it's 6.2 or 6.3, at least sometimes, do that for you. They'll actually add the cast. They won't do it all the time. There was at least one or two places where I know they didn't do it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, then you kind of go back and forth. Hey, this is, you know, you've changed this and it doesn't match. You've changed it again and it doesn't match. But it works a decent amount of the time now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's nice. But they will also, again, this may be in the beta versions of Xcode, they will go ahead and say, you know, if you use Fabs F, which is the float version of absolute value for floating point numbers, but it's using a CG float and you're building on 64-bit, it will recommend you switch to Fabs. And it will actually, I think it might do it for you. I think it definitely encourages you to do that. And again, this is all, so like, you know, okay, use the double version everywhere, but that means you're also using the double version for your 32-bit platform as well,
mm-hmm.
which means there you are doing an extra conversion that you don't need to.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, the think about the after stage. Where you really don't want to have all this code, which is, you know, kind of optimized, in as much as it matters, it doesn't really matter that much, but as much as it matters, is optimized for 32-bit when you're spending the rest of your life in 64-bit land. Title. So, and you don't want to do that. So I think what they're doing is generally the right idea. It's a little messy, but it does get you there in a way that doesn't really leave you too badly off for 32-bit. I did find that with some of these upgrades to double versions of standard library functions, there was at least one case where I did some performance testing, and even though you would think it would be slower if you did those changes in 32-bit, it was actually a little faster.
Hmm.
Now, I was testing all of the 64-bit changes at once. I wasn't trying to isolate just one. But just the fact that 32-bit would be faster with 64-bit types, in as much as they use them, was a little bit of a surprise to me. Not a huge surprise. You know, maybe they put some effort into making the libraries work well with those types on all platforms. I don't know. Maybe it's just that whatever you thought was going to be the downsides of it just weren't that important. I don't know. But I do know that it, you know, obviously it goes pretty well. I found with this transition, as well as all the other migrations that I went through, there really weren't any problems like that. There weren't any performance problems that we noticed. There wasn't anything that made me think, oh, God, you shouldn't have done that, you know? Well, except maybe one thing. ARM64 will blow up more easily if you use the wrong signature when invoking a method dynamically. Wolf, have you noticed this?
I don't think so.
Because I actually, this happened to me twice with the latest migration, that people were not being careful with the signature specification, specifying the right type of parameter, not specifying the parameter at all when there should have been one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only blowing up in 64-bit versions. Actually, in one case, it was blowing up on the simulator. In one case, it was blowing up on the device. So I guess it's just 64-bit in general can bring mm-hmm. this stuff out.
So are you talking like the add selector stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. And then more, using the dynamically invoke it?
It's more than that. It's like, I think Swizzling was involved in one case.
Mm-hmm.
And so not just like perform selector.
Okay.
More than that.
Yeah, I can see why that'd be problematic.
The deeper level, right. And yet people were getting away with it on earlier platforms without it being that big of a deal. And so I think also in beta versions of Xcode, there are more warnings about turning on, like when you upgrade your project, they recommend you turn on some of these more strict, I don't think it's called signature, I think like parameter types, whatever, that there's a warning which will now make this stuff show up when it happens. And you should listen to those warnings, is my advice, if you are seeing them now.
Mm-hmm.
That's it for me.
Okay, then I'll attack my topic. I guess I should address your topic a little bit. I have to think back about it, but I seem to remember like when the like NS Integer stuff came out. That was probably, I don't know, 5 years back now. And I remember thinking that it just seemed like, when I kind of thought it through, it seemed wrong. Like, it seemed like the wrong solution to the problem. But I don't think I actually addressed it from your standpoint of, maybe I was thinking about it from the transition period and not the post-64-bit period. You made a good case there, so I'm going to have to... I don't even remember my original arguments now, so I'd have to go through and rethink it out again, but now thinking about your points. So maybe I'll come back to you later, and I'll tell you whether you're full of it.
Okay.
So my topic is branches versus feature flags. So this is something that has been kind of on my mind for a while now, and Avi Bryant had a tweet that I'll link to that jogged my mind on it, and the tweet is... the thing I miss from Etsy is that discouraging branches serves as a huge encouragement to use feature flags, which is a good thing. So the idea here is that let's kind of walk through a hypothetical app, and we can think about how we would add a feature using feature branches or using a feature flag. So if we let's say we had a Twitter client that. That's a run-of-the-mill Twitter client, but maybe you want to add some sentiment analysis to it so that a lot of tweets about llamas' addresses don't show up. So the idea here is that you probably need maybe an addition on your pref pane where you have a checkbox, maybe a couple of checkboxes, one about if it's about llamas, don't show it, if it's about addresses, don't show it. But if there's... But you also probably need some functionality in terms of like the back engine. So it's the non-user interface code that processes the tweets and decides on whether it should discard it. So the idea here is that how would you go about doing this with branching? That's pretty straightforward. It works even if you didn't use version control at all. If you didn't use version control at all, it'd be straightforward. You just make your changes, right? Version control makes it a little bit more higher level semantically that you can start a feature branch. Git flow is a pretty popular kind of workflow that you can put on top of Git for this type of stuff, where actually you can do things like git flow feature start, and you name the feature, and it'll create the branch for you from master and stuff like that. And then when your feature is done, you actually say it's done, and it forces you to try to commit for it and all that. So then you go make your change, and the idea of the feature branch is that, let's say, it turns out sentiment analysis is kind of hard, kind of computer sciencey thing that takes you a while, and let's say you want to start from scratch, so it might take you a month and learn everything and write all the code yourself. And in the meantime, Twitter changes API is going to break you, so you need to do a feature release. Not a feature release. Basically, it's not even bug fix release. It's like you need to change how you interact with Twitter API. They've done this a bunch in the past, so like jumping from from integers that are 64-bit related to stringifying them, so JavaScript actually can be represented in JSON. But anyway, that's this JSON JavaScript for you. Those wacky duos. Here you are, kind of like neck deep in your new feature branch, but you need to ship this thing. So this is exactly where feature branches. Really shine, because you can go onto the master branch, do your little bug fix thing, and then merge it onto your feature branch, and you can go along your merry way and actually ship before the feature is done. You can ship the bug fix release.
Right, it pushes the pain off to the merge, not to the work.
Exactly, and so and ideally you finish off the feature and you merge it into master and you're done. And that's a pretty good story and works pretty well for one-person team working on one feature at a time. Or as we saw, if you have like a bug fix or a minor feature you need to ship in the meantime, this works pretty well. Problem is, it doesn't scale too well and has a bunch of other problems. If you think about, imagine if you had multiple people working on multiple features. So I'm working on llama detection and you're working on dress detection. And we're kind of splitting it up and if there's a bug fix that needs to be landed, you can see it starts getting problematic in terms of, we might have like this critical merge at the end. Well, I've changed some things in some ways that you didn't foresee and vice versa. And yep. At that point, you're basically delegating the merge pain all the way into the last possible moment. And that's actually a bad scene. Because that's the point. If we just had like a little bit more like interaction between us as we were both working on a feature, we could have actually saved a lot of pain. So one of the concepts that I like is kind of fail fast and kind of front loading pain. So it's like in cycling, when you start out, if you have a choice between two routes where you encounter hills early in the route or later in the route, you probably should go with the route that you attack the hills earlier, because that's when you're strongest. And then it's just terrible at the end of the ride when you're tired and you have to attack some hills. So similar to that.
Or like, escape from the police.
Okay. Is there some reference there I'm not getting?
That's the llama thing.
Oh, there we go. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Do we actually need to link to the llama? I think we have to because
now we do.
People are going to forget about this like in 2 days. So by the time this episode is out, people are already forgotten.
Well, now we're topical, right?
There we go.
This is just today.
There are good examples of kind of using the idea of feature flags instead of branches for this code. So the idea is that instead of me kind of having my own sandbox that I go play and develop in, and only after something is done do I end up merging into the master branch, I start implementing my features on the master branch immediately from day one. And the idea is that the feature is not visible until... unless a specific flag is somehow set. And so as the guy who's actually working on the feature, I would set that flag on my machine. And you, Andrew, you wouldn't actually see my feature. And as you're working on your stuff, I wouldn't see yours, even though we are both committing to master at the same time. And so there's going to be a lot more crosstalk, but it would be much more incremental. And there won't be the big fat pie... surprise at the end when the merges don't work, and then we had to puzzle things out. So Etsy has a GitHub repository on this. They call it feature that kind of separates. It kind of gives support for feature flags on this. Chrome is obviously a notable Mac app that uses feature flags extensively. And when I'm kind of waving my hands here on feature flags, so I'll give a specific example. I define them as, there's basically two levels. There's compile time feature flags, and there's runtime feature flags. The compile time feature flags is the type of stuff you use pound define and pound if for. Runtime is when you're actually checking at runtime to see whether you should implement things. So Etsy uses runtime feature flags. Now that I think about it, I'm pretty sure Stripe does some sort of thing like runtime feature flag detection that they have blog posting on that I'll try to dig up for the episode, show notes. In general, software, I like keeping software soft. So, runtime feature flags, I think, are preferable, for a number of reasons. Number one, that it's just easier to create combinations of features without having to recompile. So I could turn on both llama detection and dress detection in my Twitter client and the bug fix or any combination of those matrices at runtime without having to go through recompilation. And if you have a dedicated QA team, this is good to throw them so they don't have to go and recompile at all to test all these possibilities. It's just basically... and often you don't even need to restart the app, although practically you probably do. So there's also, not only do you just have the kind of like runtime detection, I would say that I would even further subdivide that into kind of launch time feature detection and actual like normal runtime feature detection. So Chrome actually has I think, two variants of this. Now that I think about the flags, might be the same thing. But it turns out that you can, when you're launching Mac apps, of course, there are Unix tools underneath the hood. So yeah, you can totally thus go in the terminal and launch these things on the terminal. And you can pass, just like Unix tools, you can pass dash dash arguments to them. You can define whatever you want in there. And so you could say, in my case, I could, if I'm working on the llama detection feature, I could put in dash dash detect llamas, and that would be my boot time or launch time feature detection flag, that when the app starts up and deciding and whether or not to show the checkbox in the nib, or whether when I start processing tweets, whether I should detect llamas, I would end up checking that Boolean. And it turns out NSUser defaults is really good for this type of stuff. It actually has a hierarchical kind of setting mechanism where you can use a persistent thing, where you can use a defaults write. You can pass it in as environmental variables. You can do a command line. You can do the command line dash dash type stuff, although in user defaults, it's actually just single dash. And there's also, you can even embed it in your info plist, I believe. Well, actually, I think I just did that for my own JR log engine. I think that's something you have to specifically look for. But yeah, it's really flexible, and it's all built in. You don't have to write like this hierarchical descending code. So let's let Apple do the work for you. So at runtime, this is where you get things like the debug menu, where you can turn things on and off. And those could be tied to user defaults too. So the debug menu is pretty standard technique for this type of stuff, and isn't necessarily tied to the idea of runtime feature flags, but I have seen in common enough usage that I want to give a shout out to that. So in general, I would say that the feature flags versus branches, its use to you is probably dependent on the size of the organization and application size. So if you're the lone guy working on the app and you only need to knock out big features serially with the uncommon case of having to do like a quick little release off master, then I think you're going to be fine with feature flags. But as soon as you scale out a little bit, I would probably recommend looking to feature flags for adding features perfectly at runtime.
So if you're a lone wolf, you're okay?
I tried not to say lone wolf. Mm.
So I was thinking about this, and it occurs to me that these are different mechanisms for doing the same thing, which is allowing multiple people to work on the same thing without breaking it.
Yeah.
And in the end, I think whatever combination of these you use, you still can't actually have two people doing significant changes on the same part of the code base at the same time and not have problems. You're just always going to have that, whether it's feature flags, whether it's branches. When they attempt to merge together, when they attempt to make their stuff work together, they have to actually talk or interact in some way or deal with it somehow. And so if it's branches, then the merge is where that happens. If it's feature flags, it might come down to the individual commits for the people. Because if you're committing one after another, you still have to merge with each other. If somebody commits something, even if it's small, and then you commit something else, and they commit something else, and then you commit something else, that might mean that you don't have merge conflicts because it's staggered like that. But if you're building two completely different systems in the same file over top of what was there before, you're going to screw each other up. And so for me, it's important, you know, exactly which system you use is dependent on what people are comfortable with, I suppose. But you still need to make sure you don't break each other. And I think the reason why this stuff tends to work out for most teams, for most companies, most of the time, is that you really don't have two people working on the same area. Like, you don't have two people doing the same feature at the same time, right? That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
You've got them working the same feature, but you're working on this piece and I'm working on this other piece. So what in practice happens is the conflicts come at the incidental points that they just happen to both be touching at the same time. It's not because of like semantic work. It's because of incidental work that things go wrong. And what's the best way around that? Well, I don't know. I do know that I have seen times with larger groups of people all trying to merge at the end of a sprint to the same code base, and that was very gnarly. That was not a great idea. On the other hand, if you have a large team and you want to work quickly, I'm not sure what other choices you have, because if people are committing all the time, in some ways that just prolongs the time period where you have conflicts. So I'm not quite sure what the best way to... Actually, no, I do have one preference, and that is, from what I've seen with feature flags, what you're saying with feature flags is, instead of trusting the merge system to figure out the things at the end, you're going to trust the people to not screw up the functionality of the app with each check-in. And I'm not sure I trust people more than I trust machines. So, if you know, you might be in the middle of your work, you've been checking into to trunk, to dev the whole time, and suddenly your stuff stops working, or it works wrong, or it works differently, or it goes slower, or whatever. And, oh, that's because so-and-so was working on another feature, and they had turned it off with their flag. They thought they were stopping everything, but they couldn't help but change something about how the regular flow of the system, the regular steps of how the app works, they couldn't help but actually change that. And I think that would happen, especially as you get larger, that's going to happen more often than not. And it's going to happen, actually, it might not happen that often, but when it does, it's going to be really frustrating, like enough to really demoralize you. So I would still tend to say, for the most part, I'd rather have merges. I'd rather you work completely separately.
That's interesting. So if we use the dress detection and the llama detection feature that we were both working on, a good example of, like, where we'd run into a conflict is I want to add a checkbox to the pref pane for llama detection, and you want to add it for address detection. You probably wouldn't, you know, I don't even know. I mean, zips have gotten nicer with storyboards, as we've talked about previously, but I wouldn't rely on that merge working out, especially because probably we're going to put that checkbox at the bottom of the panel together, and at least, if best case scenario, they'll probably overlap each other, and that's the best
case. Hopefully you go to your designer and be like, okay, we've got to add both of these things in.
Yeah.
What's the best place to put them?
That's a good point. There's definitely a serialization point there, but let's continue this on for a thought experiment. So if I want to add checkbox and you want to add checkbox, and we have some sort of preferences window controller deal, or ideally it'd be more like a view controller, but let's just call it view controller. So I would create a new class called preferences window llama controller, and you'd create one preferences window dress controller, and we'd both add our feature. And then remember that these classes can exist at the same time, right? And so what happens if both features are added? Well, remember, the feature detection, actually, these flags are read at runtime. So sometime that's our synchronization point, that there's going to be an ordering here when the user chooses preferences from the Apple menu, or what, file menu. I don't even know what menu it is. I think it's Apple menu, right? No, file menu. No, application menu. That's it. That's it. In between. you can tell I'm a classic macOS guy. I forgot we have an application menu. So it has to decide which class it's going to be instantiated. And that's our serialization point. That's where we can definitely have the merge conflict there. And in terms of, we have to decide who gets to go first. But I think that's less of an issue between having someone who actually lays out the design and kind of who's going to lay out the features for the sprint, and whose flag is going to be read first, versus the textual merge at the end. So I'm still on the side of the feature flags, runtime feature flags.
Your team feature flag.
Team feature flag. Yeah.
I'm pretty much team branch.
Okay. So. Okay. Finally, we found something to disagree about.
Yes. Even if it does involve llamas. All right. So if that's what you have,
does it for me.
Then we'll see you next time.